HBR presents.
So it's Monday morning. My family and I are on a brief little vacation. I open my email, get an email from Kevin Kwan, who's a friend, who's the author of Crazy Rich Asians.
Who follows you on Instagram, as one does.
And he's a watch collector. And he sent me an email and said, "We're filming Crazy Rich Asians in Malaysia right now. We're filming a watch scene on Wednesday. The director, John M. Chu, would like to have a serious watch. There was a watch that had been loaned to the production from Hublot, but he didn't think that would impress watch collectors."
Sorry, Hublot.
"And is there any way you can help us find a watch?"
That's Eric Wind. He's one of the world's leading experts when it comes to vintage watches. I'm your host, Patrick McGinnis, and this is FOMO Sapiens, part of the HBR Presents Network. My name is Patrick McGinnis, and I'm the guy who invented the term FOMO. That's short for fear of missing out. Today, FOMO is an epidemic, and it's changing us so much that it sort of feels like we're evolving into a new species. But FOMO doesn't have to take over your life. You can find the power to choose what you actually want and the courage to miss out on the rest. I'll show you how, right here on FOMO Sapiens. FOMO. The world of collecting is one in which FOMO can drive aficionados to drop hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars on that one special item that will fill out their collection and give everyone else FOMO. From art to cars to watches, collectors operate within a market where emotion can easily trump logic. Even though it's often thought of as the realm of hobbyists, collecting is a big business, and you can learn strategies and secrets to make the most of your time and money. My guest today is going to pull back the curtain on this hidden world for us. Eric Wind owns Wind Vintage, a company dedicated to offering exceptional watches for sale at all price points and providing advisory services to top vintage watch collectors worldwide. Eric previously served as Vice President Senior Specialist for Christie's, where he helped lead the sale of a number of important watches at auction. He has been featured and quoted in the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Wall Street Journal, and the Financial Times, and he has written for Hodinkee. He is a graduate of my alma mater, Georgetown University, and Oxford University. Eric Wind, welcome to FOMO Sapiens.
Thanks, Patrick, for having me.
It's a pleasure. So I like to start my show by asking everybody the same question. And the question is, we all get a little FOMO sometimes. So what turns you into a FOMO Sapiens?
The biggest thing is just email, I would say. People cold emailing, trying to respond in a timely manner. They're looking for a watch. They're looking at a watch on my website. Collaboration opportunity, etc. So those are definitely get me concerned about responding.
Are you one of these people who responds to emails right away, like the zero inbox? Because I'm zero inbox.
I try, but it's very difficult.
It's a tyranny. It's the tyranny of email.
It is. I hate email.
So, Eric, the reason why, I mean, I get why you need to respond to email quickly, because you are you're a global man of intrigue. And, you know, to show, I guess, the listeners kind of what you do, I want you to tell the story about Crazy Rich Asians, because this story, I remember hearing this from, we went to the same university, we have lots of friends in common. And when I heard the story, it gave me FOMO. Because I just thought it was so cool that I wish it was me that this happened to. So tell me the story.
So it's Monday morning. My family and I are on a brief little vacation. I open my email, get an email from Kevin Kwan, who's a friend, who's the author of Crazy Rich Asians.
Who follows you on Instagram,
as one does. And he's a watch collector. And he sent me an email and said, "We're filming Crazy Rich Asians in Malaysia right now. We're filming a watch scene on Wednesday. The director, John M. Chu, would like to have a serious watch. There was a watch that had been loaned to the production from Hublot, but he didn't think that would impress watch collectors."
Sorry, Hublot.
"And is there any way you can help us find a watch?" So my mind begins thinking about, if I run to New York, I was in Florida at the time, get a watch, fly there, that's probably 24 hours to get there via, would have to fly through an intermediate place like Dubai or something. I had been to Indonesia recently through Dubai. And That was a FOMO moment. I'm like, how am I going to get a watch there? There's not enough time to get it there for filming on Wednesday. And it was like hours away. So I began calling collector clients in Asia, Hong Kong, Indonesia, etc. No one really knew what Crazy Rich Asians was. The book is more popular in the West at that time than in Asia, funnily enough. So, and also these are, you know, six-figure watches. They're fragile. Everyone worries about a non-expert holding the watch. If you dropped it, you could lose hundreds of thousands in value with loom falling off or dials cracking, etc. So no one was really eager to loan a watch. Finally, I called another dealer in California, Eric Kuz, a friend of mine, and said, do you have any ideas? He had a client in Singapore who had a few watches, and he actually had talked with the client and knew the client's wife was a fan of Crazy Rich Asians, which was just unusual because that was before the global phenomenon of the movie. So, and during that time, I also reached out to a few brands, Jaeger LeCoultre, or Jaeger LeCoultre, as we say in the U.S. and others.
Wow, I didn't know that's how you pronounce it.
So they were like, they didn't really understand it either. And to turn around something within a day is very difficult, obviously, with insurance and all these other things. So ended up connecting with a collector by the afternoon in Singapore who said he would loan his watch. Logistics were confirmed. They sent a security guard to Singapore from Malaysia. He flew over, flew it back, and then they filmed the scene. And the director wasn't even aware of all the logistics. We were in touch with like maybe eight different prop people, et cetera, during this time. There was insurance forms filled out and all these things. And by the end of the day, we heard that they filmed the scene and it went really well and they could return the watch the next day.
So, and how long is the scene, by the way, just for those of us who maybe watch
it? It's about 10 seconds when Astrid's character gives the watch to her husband.
Oh, and he doesn't like the watch because he doesn't want to be a mate, you know.
Yeah, and he's shirtless in bed, and then she hands him a $600,000 watch and says, you're a CEO, you can dress like it now.
Yes, so, well, Astrid, if you need to give the watch to somebody else, Eric and I are here.
Yes, definitely.
That's an amazing story, and it shows you, I think it's quite impressive that they went through all this. It also shows you the kind of network that you've built in the watch world that you were able to basically talk to everybody who's everybody and then pull something together.
It was crazy. Yeah. And it was really interesting.
Wow. So you're in this watch world, and the other night you spoke at the Horological Society of New York, and I dropped in where I saw all the horologs. Is that
exactly horologists at least.
the fans of horology were horophiles, all in attendance, and it was amazing because the word that I heard over and over again that night, besides things like crystal and strap, was Instagram. And in fact, the way that the event was described in the email, it said, and this is in quotes, "The field of vintage watches is an interesting place, with more minefields than ever in the realm of collecting, a staggering amount of animosity on social media and watch fora." Yeah. So I didn't realize that this is worse than sort of political discussions on Facebook.
It is getting Trumpified, the world of watch collecting.
So talk about that. Why does Instagram matter in the world of watches? What is happening, and how does this play out in the collection space?
Instagram has done a few things. One, it's been a place for collectors to show off their watch collections. It's not uncommon for dealers I speak with to spend 2 to 3 hours per day on Instagram.
Wow.
Writing people, posting stuff for sale, trying to buy watches that people show, doing hashtag searches for different models, which I do sometimes if I'm looking for something. It has become a really big part of the community, which it wasn't 8 years ago or 6 years ago. So there's been a rise in values, all these different personalities. There are a bunch of spoof accounts now that make fun of people, make fun of dealers, make fun of auction houses. there's some good humor for sure, which you get to laugh at, and there's some really nasty things being written. And the watch fora, which have traditionally been a place for scholarship and research and kind of watch nerds, as we call them, to support each other and say, hey, look at this cool thing. I think as values have also risen a lot, have become places where there's a lot of backbiting and jealousy and animosity. There's still definitely a large group of people that are very nice, but it's tainted by the maybe 5% of people that are really bad apples.
And are these people who are trolling, do they even have nice watches, or are they kind of the bystanders?
A lot of times they don't, and they're mad that the market has passed by them, or that they bought the things that haven't gone up in value, things like that. So, yeah, generally these people aren't the most successful. Otherwise, they wouldn't be spending their time sort of ripping other people.
Fair point. It's funny because I actually have followed a couple of the Instagram accounts for a period of time. But I always unfollow because there's a lot of hairy wrists in an Instagram. It's just true, right?
The only thing worse than a hairy wrist, though, are some people that shave their wrists and you see the little stubble. It's hilarious.
Oh, no. Yeah, so I would watch them, and I find it really interesting. And I've seen, you know, you display, for example, in New York City, there's a store called Rolling Blazers, which is owned by a former guest on the show, Jack Carlson. And you have a bunch of your watches on display, and they're in a case, and they're beautiful. And so I enjoy watching them. But sans hairy wrist, the hairy wrist brings a whole other element to it.
Definitely.
So you got into this. You got into this world. I don't know how one gets into the world of watches, but this is something that you went to Georgetown. You then worked in sort of PR in DC. Then you went and got an MBA at Oxford, and then you went and started working in a startup in Florida. But all the time, on the side as a 10% entrepreneur, as we call it, which is, if you haven't heard about 10% entrepreneurs, it's a book I wrote a couple of years ago about how to be an entrepreneur without quitting your day job. Eric was doing this. And then you eventually transitioned. You made like one of the most inspiring leaps I've ever seen from this startup, kind of doing this on the side, to actually being at Christie's, you know, which is one of the, I guess, the place where all the action is. How did this all happen? How did you get into this world? And how did you go after your dream? Because I think that's pretty audacious.
It was never something planned. I was passionate about watches, got interested toward the end of college. It started with my grandfather's watch, which my mother gave to me. It was a simple Hamilton that my grandmother gave to him for their wedding in 1947.
Nice.
It was my first mechanical watch, and I was just amazed by this world of, you know, 200 parts keeping time accurately and that was, you know, 70 years old almost, I guess at that time over 60 years old. So that was the start, and then you begin reading blogs, watch fora, talking with collectors, buying things on eBay, kind of bidding on things, losing a lot but occasionally winning. You know, just starting with $300-$400 Seikos, then moving up to some Hoyers in the $1,000-$2,000 range, and then going up from there. And then you can make a little money, maybe flipping something you don't like exactly because you bought it well. And then it just becomes like a fun hobby. So around that time, Hodinkee started, which was how I really got into it. I was very interested. It was primarily vintage watches at that time. And I got to know the founder, Ben Clymer. He was about to start journalism school at Columbia and asked if I wanted to start writing back in 2010. And I said, sure, that'd be amazing. So then I started writing. That really forces you to learn a lot more because you're writing for an audience and you can't have inaccurate statements.
The trolls will come after
you. Yeah, so if you write something wrong, people will have pitchforks out. So I did that for 5 years, including while I was at Oxford, a little bit doing an MBA. And then I sort of ramped it up more after when I got a job with a biofuel venture. Then during that time, I got to know the key actors in the auction world because I was writing about auctions and no one else really was. So I got to know John Reardon over the course of 4 years. He's became the head of Christie's. And there was a big shakeup where a lot of personnel had left Christie's to go to Phillips. They were in need of some more people. He approached me a couple times. I said, you know, I really they said, if you want to stay in Florida, you could be a consultant. Otherwise, you can move to New York and be full time. But the pay isn't amazing to have a family in New York City. So I said, well, I'd really want to stay in Florida. Obviously, I need benefits like health insurance and all those things. So he worked it out eventually where I think I became the first specialist at Christie's. I had become a senior specialist with full benefits working from home, basically, and 200 plus years of history. But
making history one watch at a time.
Yeah, so then it was a really busy experience, a lot of travel. I was probably on the road 50 to 60% of the time, which is a lot with a young family, but you're traveling overseas to all the auctions, traveling across the U.S. to get watches, to meet with collectors. And then after about 2.5 years, I decided I was in a position where I knew a lot of people, had a very positive reputation in the community, and could start my own company. So that was also a leap of faith to do that.
That's amazing. And what I love about the story is I watched this as a friend. I remember Eric took this job in Florida at this startup, and I thought, like, you know, that sounds interesting, but this guy should be working in watches. And, you know, this is what he loves. He's passionate. Yeah. But, you know, you hadn't quite found your entry yet. And then, you know, I thought you should be the 10% watch entrepreneur, maybe.
Yes, definitely.
It's a terrible joke. It's a dad joke right there. Yeah. But I remember the day that you announced you were going to Christie's. And you already had a big following in the watch world because of Hodinkee. And, you know, if you don't know Hodinkee is the place to go. Check it out for watches. It's a really smart, well-written site. And they also, like John Mayer, the singer, writes for Hodinkee. It's a really cool kind of, you know, part of the internet. And Eric posted on Instagram, good old Instagram, that he was going to do this job. And I never saw as many likes. It was like watching somebody self-actualize in one post. So nice. It really was. I mean that. And you know, to see somebody go after what they wanted and to then succeed at it. And as I said the other night at the Horological Society, it was like, you know, it was almost as if, you know, I guess you are a celebrity in the watch room. Was in the room. Everybody was taking pictures of you. It was very cool. So, you know, that's what happens when you bloom where you're planted and you pick the right garden. It's just interesting. Like, you went to Christie's, and what is that like? Who are you dealing with? Because the one thing about Eric you should know is that Eric's from Wisconsin. It's not like Eric grew up on Fifth Avenue in New York City and had 57 Rolexes as a kid. He's you know, flesh and blood. From, you know, I don't know, how big is your hometown?
34,000.
Okay, that's big compared to my hometown, man. But, you know, this is, you know, you're somebody who worked for everything you got. And then you're dropped into this world of, you know, crazy rich Asians, crazy rich Americans, crazy rich Brits, all these other people. So what is that like? How do you deal with those types of people? How do you manage that? And, you know, what's it like in that world?
It's very interesting because people have such broad array of personalities. So one thing you're dealing with may be the gentleman who bought this watch back in 1970, just learned that it's $200,000+. That might be the regular guy who, you know, was a businessman. I met, you know, people that were definitely not wealthy, but they had bought this watch because they wanted a Rolex back then. Relatively, it was a lot less expensive, I feel like, than today. And they learned it's worth a lot, so I could connect with them. But then you're dealing with, you know, titans of industry and sort of masters of the universe as well on the buying side. So you need to learn how to deal with those people as well. They're going to want it quick, snappy, and they're going to want to like you as well. So it's really an array of people you have to work with in that world.
So, Eric, I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about collecting, because you work with collectors, you are a collector. What I've learned about the watch world and listening to some of the stuff you talk about is that there's been a huge appreciation in assets. So, shocking, and maybe you'll give us some examples about how watches have appreciated in value. And there's a whole fashion element, there's a trend element. Some things get hot, then they're not anymore. It's like a couple of years ago, everybody wanted XYZ. Now you can't sell those. Now everybody wants, like, a stainless steel cases and, you know, all this stuff that is quite interesting as an outsider to watch how volatile it is. So if I, you know, let's imagine that you're talking to the Eric Wynn from 10 years ago and you're buying your first couple watches for a couple $100 on eBay. What are the keys to being a collector and to building, you know, some value and also a collection that you love?
I think the first thing is really understanding what you're buying, so looking to make sure it's all correct. These are tools, so it's very common for most of these to be to have replacement parts from service, incorrect parts, you know, bringing it to the watchmaker down the street who's jerry-rigging these things, or parts have fallen off, et cetera, and replacing them with incorrect parts. Heavily polished cases because they want it to look shiny, but then it kind of looks like an amorphous blob of metal. So that's the first thing, trying to understand what the condition is. And then really the cardinal rule is buy what you like. Don't just follow trends. And then the other rule for someone getting in is to buy the seller. So really to buy from a reputable source. The eBay is the Wild West, as I call it, because you see all kinds of fakes. It's really not a good entry point for someone without a lot of expertise or who's willing to spend a lot of time learning about it. I would say in general, watch collecting is interesting for people because it's a whole world of detail and nuance. And for people that are done with their formal education, who are still hungry to learn, this is an outlet for them. I think it's similar with cars and art as well. So a lot of people I meet are sort of very intelligent people who are looking to learn and hungry for knowledge, but also enjoy the watches themselves, enjoy wearing them, looking at them, the aesthetic element of it. So those would be sort of just quick general thoughts
on okay. this. And what about, I know there's a site out there called, I believe, Crowd and Caliber.
Yes.
So a couple of years ago, I went to an event that they did, and they kind of, they're specializing in secondhand watches. So, yep. You know, you want to buy secondhand. And if you go to a place like that, is that more advisable for maybe the beginner? Because maybe you won't get the steepest discount, but you know that the provenance is there?
It depends which way you're approaching. So within the pre-owned market, which I'd say is primarily watches from the last 20 years, that's a whole field that's being disrupted right now. There's lots of different actors trying to get large in that field. There's Bob's Watches, which is a great place for a Rolex. Crown and Caliber does sort of an array of brands. Chrono 24 is a marketplace for dealers and privates that I had raised over $20 million in investment and is getting very large, 200-plus employees. There's a company called Watchbox, which has over $100 million in inventory. This company called Watchfinder, which was primarily UK-based, was bought by Richemont as a sort of way for them to sell pre-owned or perhaps gray market. There's another company in Europe called Chronex, which has raised $20-plus
million. Wow.
Then you have sort of actors in the U.S. like The Real Real, which does watches as part of their pre-owned fashion. So there's all this disruption. The vintage world is different than those because almost all those places are 99% modern. Vintage is really before 1980, before computers were used in watch design. Things were handmade. Actually, much harder to fake because you can tell in a second if things are redone. For me, modern fake Rolexes are so good now, seeing the expensive ones that are sort of $600, that it's scary. It's very difficult for even super experts to tell. So that's part of the appeal for me, is that these are really watches made both unique by time and that were in much smaller production. It's pretty common for some of these watches that are very collectible for less than 100 or less than 50 to be known to the community, period. So they're pretty unusual and rare. If you're looking for vintage, then I would say you want to go to like a smaller dealer like myself or some other dealers that specialize in that. But if you want like a 1995 Rolex, you could go to Bob's Watches or Crown and Caliber, others like that.
Gotcha.
Or Chrono 24.
And how, it's very subjective, I imagine, at some point, because you have a reference price originally and you have sale history and things like that. But what is a watch? Every watch is a little different. Everyone has its own little history.
Yeah.
There's value if somebody famous owned it.
Yes.
You know, if you buy the watch from, maybe one day when we sell our watches, they'll have extra value.
Yes.
Probably not.
Yeah.
But if somebody's thinking about buying a watch, how negotiable is it both sort of in the vintage or in the secondary market, and also when they go to walk into the Cartier store?
So there's been, it's sort of a positive halo effect because modern watches are, have had a resurgence of their own, particularly like sport steel Rolexes. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, 10 plus year waiting lists for the new GMT, Daytona, et cetera. As someone said, it's a 50 year waiting list for the Daytona. So that's also bringing more attention to watches, and the fact that you, if you are lucky enough to buy one of these watches, you can sell it for double when you walk out onto the street is amazing and sort of brings more attention to it. With vintage watches, it is very subjective. There is huge lack of data. So what you can look at are sort of prices that were asked on forums, auction prices, depending on the model, as baselines, and search around to see what other dealers have listed them for. And then it's just a question of what you're willing to pay. And every watch is a little bit different, so it becomes a personal choice. It
becomes emotional, right? I mean, how when you think about collectors and the people you deal with, I imagine there's a range of people from the person who maybe is extraordinarily experienced, yeah, and has really built up a collection, to somebody who's just getting going or wants to buy a present for their loved one or their son or daughter or whatever.
Yeah.
How do people keep the emotion out and actually, you know, make rational decisions and not overpay for things?
That's very difficult, but I think you just have to look at the data of auction and other results to get an idea of what you should actually pay. And you have to trust where you're buying it from, that they're not charging you 5x what it should really be worth, which can happen. There's a huge amount of lack of data and transparency in the market.
Right, and you mentioned, I've heard you talk about the fact that birth year watches, so I didn't even know this was a thing.
Yeah.
Because I'm from Maine, so we don't know, we can't afford these things. But apparently people are very keen to buy a watch that's made in their birth year, which, number one, it's really hard to prove because watches, you know, they're assembled over a period of time. And number two, you may, if you're really sort of set on having that watch from, you know, 1963, you may be willing to pay a lot more for some than somebody else over the value that it is, just because you have the sentimental attachment, right?
Yes. Yep. I think that's a very negative thing that's happening. And all the dealers I talk to that are being asked for a watch from 83 or 75 or 62, that is sort of the opposite of the collecting approach, which is to buy the best possible example, something that speaks to you. It's a very arbitrary thing, and that becoming the primary thing you're looking for and you're avoiding everything else means you're not buying the best watch on the market for sure. For me, it would be a nice to have if you happen to like the model and the watch. It's kind of cool, but unfortunately that's become the first thing people look for in many cases.
That's where you should buy the fake and just tell people it's from your birth year.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody's going to know, apparently. Yeah. As long as you're not, you know, depending on your age, right?
Yes, depending on age, for sure.
Eric, I always like to ask guests the same question. This is the show about finding the power to choose what you actually want in business and life and the courage to miss out on the rest. So what's your advice to our listeners?
Of course, the most basic advice is follow your dreams, but do as much planning as you can. Make sure that you look before you leap. Put as many pieces in place as you can, and then make the leap.
Maybe consider doing it as a 10% entrepreneur.
Definitely 10% entrepreneur first.
Given that, where can people find out more about you, find you on Instagram, all these other places?
I'm at Eric M. Wind on Instagram, and my website is windvintage.com.
Thanks for dropping by, Eric, and best of luck.
Thank you.
FOMO.
And now it's time for the FOMO moment of the week. This is the time on the show where I talk about FOMO in pop culture, or maybe talk about something that's giving me FOMO or that should be giving you FOMO. And this week I want to talk about a new app I've been playing with. It's called Listen. It's a podcasting app, and it is pretty great because if you like podcasts as much as I do, and hopefully you do since you're here listening, you could probably have found that the standard podcasting apps have some things that they're missing, and they really haven't evolved as they should have done. And a friend of mine named Paul, who's a 10% entrepreneur and actually developed an app in his free time outside of his day job, has launched this company, Listen. And this is not an ad. I'm just using it and liking it. Why do I like it? Basically, because it's very easy to use. It's beautiful to look at. The interface is really clean. It's easy to use with one hand. You can customize everything you need to customize. And it's just kind of a modern approach on podcasting. So it's done by somebody who actually has a podcast himself and loves podcasts as much as I do. FOMO. If you have an idea for the FOMO moment of the week or you have a question, reach out to me at letsconnect@patrickmcginnis.com or send me a tweet at PJMcGinnis. Also, you can take the official FOMO Sapiens diagnostic at patrickmcginnis.com/FOMO-quiz and find out if you're a FOMO Sapiens. FOMO Sapiens is part of the HBR Presents Network. The show is produced by AW360 and recorded in New York City. Theme music is by Mike McGinnis. If you like today's show, please be sure to subscribe, rate it, and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me at patrickmcginnis.com. You can also take the official FOMO diagnostic at patrickmcginnis.com/FOMO-quiz to find out if you're a FOMO Sapiens.